The following lecture is under copyright by Reformation Christian Ministries and is for your personal use only. It is not to be copied or otherwise distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. Contact information will be provided at the end of this lecture.
We talked about the spread of Christianity outside of the Roman Empire, and pretty much just followed the notes. I pointed out on the map that it spread beyond the borders of the empire, and at Dura Europa here, this town that's listed on this map, at Dura, there was a church, a stone building church that has been discovered by archaeologists about the time of 230. And then there was Christianity up along the Black Sea, over into Armenia. We talked about the story there of Gregory of Armenia. There's a lot of Gregories in the history of the church, and this can really get out of hand. but we call him Gregory of Armenia, because later on there was a Gregory of Cappadocia, and we'll have to talk about the three Cappadocians. Gregory of Armenia took the gospel back and convinced the king to be a Christian, and that whole country then, Armenia, became Christian. And that's the fight today in Armenia, you know, between the Muslims and the Christians, huh? That's going on yet today. Now, the Armenian Christians are a little different. They're a little bit archaic, I guess we'd say. They have pretty much what we would call about 5th or 6th century Christianity in some respect. Okay. It's not that there hasn't been any development, but the development has certainly been different than what you had in the Western Church. And then we talked about persecution. We talked about Nero as the first persecutor of the Church, and we pointed out particularly at something that's not on the notes, and that was pretty much localized at Rome, that there was not much persecution outside of Rome as a result of Nero. As I said, Nero didn't have much vision. And then I mentioned some of the other fellows who were martyrs. Ignatius of Antioch, a very popular bishop in a powerful church, was taken to Rome and executed by about 117, and he wrote letters on the way. The Romans were very courteous to Ignatius, even though they insisted on executing him. By the way, I really think that's the way we ought to be to people who are to be executed. I don't think we should spit on them and so on. I think that we should. That's a very serious thing when someone is executed, but we should treat them courteously, teach them to pray, and then put them to death. I think that simply our own humility because of our own sin should tell us that, but for the grace of God go I. And so we ought to respect them as human beings, even though God's law says a person who has done this particular thing ought to be executed. I think the Romans, on the one hand, were when they made a spectacle of Christians, and when it became popular to torture Christians, the excesses were terrible. You see that with Nero. And at the same time, a lot of times, the Roman government officials were pretty humane in their treatment of people, especially in their treatment of Roman citizens. And the story is that they were very nice to Polycarp. They just said, all you have to do, and they tried to give him all the chance that they could from their perspective, huh? All you have to do is say that you're not a Christian and we won't execute you. And he answered, as I said, sorry, I've been a Christian for all these years and Christ has never failed me. It would be rather gauche to fail him at this point. So he refused and was put to death. As I said, Justin, martyr, was a converted, I didn't talk much about Justin, was a converted philosopher. He had studied philosophy and so on. And when you read his apologies, you'll find out that Greek philosophy Justin started something, or is one of the earliest representatives of the idea that Christianity is really true philosophy. The true philosophers are also saved, such as Plato and Aristotle and so on. If you find the truth, you see, the truth will save you. Well, the truth does save you, but it's a little different truth than Plato and Aristotle had. But that idea and some of the non-Christians said, well, look, the Christians are more moral than some real philosophers. And so they respected the Christians for their morality, because they saw in the Christians things that the philosophers talked about, restraint and honesty and care of the sick and so on. And so they respected the Christians for that. Okay, then we said Domitian, the capital B at the bottom of page 4, called himself a master and God, and even though his persecution was localized, that was pretty tough on Christians, and he was pretty tough on Christians because of his insistence that he was God, or a God at least, and ought to be worshipped. And that's the thing that was really the stumbling block for Christians, was the worship of false gods. And I think that comes out of the Bible, you know, the first commandment, to say nothing of the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and so on. I'm not surprised that Christians do that. The Christians in Japan ran into that in Korea with the Shinto requirements of the Japanese government. The Japanese government went so far in certain areas, in China especially, and Korea, to say that you don't have to worship at the Shinto shrine as though it were religious. You can do this as a civil duty, kind of like paying your taxes or putting a license plate on your car. Huh? I mean, that's not bowing down. That's not worshiping the state to put a license on your car. And so you should look at the requirement of the government that you bow at the Shinto shrine in that respect. You shouldn't look at it as a religious thing. And that suborned a lot of Christians.
That what?
That suborned them, that got them to go ahead and do it.
Oh.
Okay? It compromised their faith. Okay? And so...
You think that was right or wrong?
Well, I think it was wrong. And a lot of Christians didn't do it too and lost their heads. Okay? There's a terrible story, and I probably shouldn't repeat it, about a Christian missionary from the West who was buried alive for a day at a time. They dug a hole and put him in a box and put him in there and covered it up with 6 feet of dirt.
Oh, man.
And he didn't know whether they were going to get him out or not. And I don't know about you, but that's one thing that's horrible to me, is being buried alive. Please don't do that if you get a chance. But I mean, and this guy was able to control his breathing and live through the experience several times. And of course, it's just unbelievable. How can you believe the horror of doing something like that to a person?
So they take him out and put him out?
They take him out, and then the next day they buried him again. And of course, it's amazing how cruel man can be, huh? Well, anyway, Hadrian was a different kind of a cat. As I said, he was more even-handed from a neutral perspective. He was more even-handed and did not really go after the Christians, although he allowed real Christians, people who really were Christians and refused to worship Caesar or the Roman gods, were persecuted and put to death. He demanded proof, though, that they be Christians, and he punished false accusers, because, of course, if you accuse me of being a Christian, you could have my property. And I don't know who wants my property, but that was kind of an interesting move. The Romans did that with several crimes. If you accused a person of a crime and he was found guilty, then you received his property. That was a way to get keep people on edge. Huh? Hadrian did. He was a pretty good ruler, by the way. Hadrian was a good administrator. The Roman Empire had its ups and downs. It's kind of like the Roman Catholic Church did. They had some popes that were lousy administrators. They had some really sharp guys too, from an administrative perspective. And Hadrian and several of the guys now, Hadrian, Antonius Pius, and Marcus Aurelius were very good administrators. And they strengthened the Roman Empire, Hadrian did. You know, Hadrian's Wall is up in northern England. You know, there's still pieces of Hadrian's Wall up there. He extended the Roman. See, here's the Wall of Hadrian. It's on the map. And then Antonius went further. The Wall of Antonius is at what is now the southern border of Scotland. And that's why the Scots are always kind of wild. That's why they were Presbyterians, because they were never under Roman domination much at all. That was kind of no man's land up there, where John Murray came from. Antonius Pius, again, was a persecutor of the church with some force. In fact, I think he's the guy who killed Theosophorus, the Roman bishop of that time. But again, it was mostly in and around Rome. Marcus Aurelius, on the other hand, was a man who really hated Christians. And he saw the Roman Empire crumbling at the edges, and he decided that it was because of the Christians. He hated the Christians and thought that they were bringing the wrath of the gods on Rome. This was an idea that was in the populace very often, and Justin Martyr, for example, defended the Christians against that. He said, against that charge that Christianity was bringing the wrath of the gods onto the Roman Empire. There were now some spread out persecutions. There were severe persecutions, kind of in imitation. And Marcus Aurelius did not say, he did not send letters to Gaul, but the news got along out to Gaul that there was persecution of Christians in Rome, and that the empire and the emperor hated Christians, so anybody who hated Christians, and particularly government people who hated Christians, took upon themselves to be loyal to Marcus Aurelius by killing Christians. You'll find that that's a fairly common thing that happens in the history of the world, that people become certain things when it is popular with the ruler. And since it was popular with the ruler to persecute Christians, there were some pretty severe persecutions. There are some letters from Gaul and Lyon and Vienne about the persecution of Christians. There were some pretty rough stories. Accusers may have the property of Christians convicted. He made that a law. And he beheaded Roman citizens who were Christians, others who were thrown to the beasts and made a spectacle of in the Colosseum. Roman citizens were treated less severely. They just had their heads cut off, and which is a merciful way to die, I would say, compared to being eaten alive by lions and so on. Then there was a break for about 13 years. There was a kind of a growing severity from Antoninus Pius to Marcus Aurelius. There was a break for about 13 years, and then, actually longer than that, Septimus Severus became emperor in 193. And at first he didn't do much about Christianity, but in 202 he forbade conversions to Judaism or Christianity and made that an empire-wide law. And there was severe persecution now, not so much in Gaul, but especially in Egypt and North Africa. There was tremendous persecution of the church. Origen's father was from Alexandria. That family was in Alexandria in Egypt. And Origen was a boy of 16 years old. His father was convicted of being a Christian and was going to be killed. And Origen wanted to go and die with his father. But his mother understood teenagers and realized that he wouldn't go out with his clothes without his clothes, so she hid his clothes.
Huh?
Yeah, really. And Origen, in shame, stayed home while his father was put to death. And he lived to become a great theologian. So, kind of a humorous story, but I think you can understand a son who loved his father and was a Christian too, huh? Wanting to go and die with his father. But his mother didn't think it was time yet. So he was saved by a wise mother. Then there was, after 211, you see there was about a 9-year persecution. Then after 211, after Severus died, there was a 40-year break. It's a generation, you see. There was just a brief persecution under Maximinus Thrax, when there was a short revival of persecution, but it was long enough to do much. And so there was a generation break from 211 to 250. Now comes along Decius, who became emperor in 249. And he began by putting out edicts commanding the worship of the gods, certificates to those who complied. And of course Christians were the ones who suffered most. Origen was arrested, was sent into exile, and died very shortly in exile. He was an old man by this time, and simply couldn't handle the rigors of travel and so on in those days, and so he ended up dying. And the aged bishop of Jerusalem too died in prison. Prisons were not, you didn't have color TV and 3 meals a day in prison in those days. In fact, if your friends didn't bring you anything to eat, you starved to death. Yeah. Prisons were, the state did not see that it had any responsibility to take care of prisoners. The prisoners were on their own as far as food and drink and clothing and care and that kind of thing. I was concerned. So the Christians, of course, suffered from this. Cyprian, the bishop of Carthage, a very important fellow in the history of the church, was kind of semi-exiled and took advantage of the chance for exile and left Carthage and thought it would be better to rule his bishopric from elsewhere than to die and leave his sheep without a shepherd. And that's my way of handling it, by the way. I think that's the way to go. I think he should have taken his Christians with him, though, into exile. His successor, that is, successor Gallius, or Gallus, continued the persecution, but not for too long. Indeed, through these brief persecutions, just a couple of years, the church was much more strengthened than weakened. Why did that happen? Because it was a somewhat dangerous thing to become a Christian, and so people were not false Christians. And when one of the biggest problems the church has to fight is nominalism, huh? You know what nominalism is, being Christian in name but not in fact, huh? That's something you're going to fight all your life as a Christian, as a leader of the church, hopefully. And that is that that there are people in the church because their folks were in the church, or there are people in the church because they're maybe their husband or wife is a serious Christian, and they're a Christian, kind of, okay, in outward form. And you're going to deal with that thing in many, many forms, that kind of nominalism. And you're simply going to have to be aware of that. Well, persecution takes care of nominalists pretty well, because if it costs something to be a Christian, it doesn't take long and you lose your nominal Christians. That's true in the mission field, too. You get rice Christians. You get people because the Westerners live better than the local people. They eat better. And so, for example, my wife's uncle was in Eritrea, you know, in Ethiopia. And he's a man who understood this matter very well. And yet, some of the earliest converts and some of the most suspicious converts in his mind were the housekeeper and the cook and so on. See, those people cooked over open fires. And so, in order to be like the people, they would do that as much as possible, live like the people who left. But his wife was a Western woman, and she could not stand cooking in a hut over an open fire. She just couldn't handle that. And so they hired a cook, okay, to do much of the cooking for the family. Well, of course, the cook became a Christian, and so on. It's a very interesting thing. But you know, when war broke out, when the communists took over Ethiopia, there was a lot of persecution of Christians, and it's really amazing because the church has grown and thrived in Eritrea during this terrible, terrible period, even though. It was difficult for after 30 years in Eritrea. Uncle Clarence said they could count on two hands the number of true converts they knew of in the area, because they were converts from either the local Coptic Christianity or from Mohammedanism, from Islam. And both of those were, that was a very dangerous thing to do. You'd lose your life if you were baptized. That was tough work. Even though Haile Selassie, the emperor of Ethiopia, was very open to Christian missions. So anyway, you have then some short persecutions. Then again, after that, now you have a new theory, fury of persecution, and now you have empire-wide persecution. Remember I said a term from 64 to 250, you had local persecutions. Now Valerian became very systematic. At first, it looked like Valerian was a good guy, because from 253 to 257, he was friendly to Christians. But in 257, that changed totally. He completely changed his attitude to Christians. And being a very organized fellow, very systematic fellow, he made laws about persecution. He made positive laws requiring the persecution of Christians. For example, bishops were to be exiled if they refused to do homage to the gods. Christians were to be executed for meeting attendance or for cemetery visiting. That'll get your attention. The Christians were great cemetery visitors. They had their own cemeteries, and they often, you know, they honored the martyrs.
Well, why did he change? Why are they friendly? Well, a lot of these guys were friendly at first, and they changed. What was the cause?
I think that basically it was the idea that Rome was disintegrating, the Roman Empire was disintegrating, and you had to blame somebody. And if you're going to do that, who are you going to blame for your problems? Generally, you're like me, you're going to blame somebody else rather than yourself. Mm-hmm.
But if it was disintegrating over a period of time, why would the attitude towards Christians fluctuate?
Well, because you had a new emperor.
Unless the situation was up and down.
Well, that's true, of course. And if things look good for the empire...
Then you're a Christian, huh?
Sure. You know, then you're not so mad at Christians. It's just like your family life, Tony. It has its ups and downs. And when it has its downs, who do you blame? Your wife.
That's the way it works.
Yeah, that's the way human nature is, huh? You blame somebody else, don't you, Henry?
All the time.
Yeah. Funny thing, your wife does that too. That's the kind of thing. I think that's as good an explanation as I can give for that.
I wondered about that.
Too satisfying to you, but it's true. Said a much more carefully thought out persecution, as I say. He was a systematic cat. It didn't work. Christianity was not wiped out. So in 258, he came out with a new and worse set of edicts. Death for all bishops, presbyters, and deacons. Now we're getting serious. Death for Christians of high rank in the Roman government. Confiscation of goods and banishment for matrons. They were nicer to women a little bit. Slavery for Christians in the imperial household. And now, as a result of the fact that there were imperial edicts about this, number four is important. In at least the majority of the provinces, there was persecution that was very severe as a result of this. Cyprian didn't get away with it this time. He was beheaded in Africa. The Roman bishop was captured and killed, along with all his deacons. The Roman church was simply left headless. Without office bearers. Finally, fortunately, Valeria went off on an expedition of war against the Persians, and he was caught by the Persians. And even though they didn't kill him, that was the end of the persecution, because his son became the emperor, and Gallienus, Valerian's son, reversed the policy of persecution. And interestingly, during all this period, by now, the church was the strongest numerical group in the empire, and it was only exceeded by the government in influence and power. Mm. So you have kind of a history of persecution that goes here for about 100 years and on local persecution, and now there's going to be about 70 years or 50 years of empire-wide persecution, and then you're going to have Constantine. Okay.
Perhaps that's one of the reasons why they kept persecuting Christians, because the church kept growing. Maybe that's
Sure. I mean, it's like the Israelites in Egypt, huh?
Yeah.
Their growth and power was not something. You know, one of the things that the Roman emperors were very afraid of, and that was why when things went bad, was these Christians over here on the borders of the empire were seen as potential traitors, huh? They're not loyal to the Roman gods. So if the Medians come in and take over, these Christians aren't going to care. They're not going to fight to maintain the Roman Empire. As a matter of fact, they might be happy to see us go, because we've been persecuting them a little bit.
Maybe there was some truth to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Why not? Sure.
But that's not necessarily good of the Christians in those days to do that.
Well, if you've been persecuted by the government, you probably are fairly sympathetic to somebody who says, we're going to come in and not persecute you. I think I'd be that one.
This lecture is copyrighted by Reformation Christian Ministries, the parent organization of Reformation International Theological Seminary and Reformation International College. This audio lecture is protected under international copyright law and is not to be copied, distributed, sold, or used commercially without the specific written permission of Reformation Christian Ministries. You may contact Reformation Christian Ministries through our website at www.reformation.edu. Reformation is spelled R-E-F-O-R-M-A-T-I-O-N. By email, you can also contact us at president@reformation.edu. By phone in the U.S., you can reach us at 772-571-8833, or by writing to Reformation Christian Ministries, 13950 122 Street, Fellsmere, Florida, 32948 in the USA.